Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's great to have Mark Manson on the podcast. His blog, markmanson.net, attracts more than 2 million readers per month. Mark is the New York Times and international bestselling author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, with over 6 million in sales in the U.S. alone, and his latest book is called Everything is Fucked, a book about hope. Mark, so great to chat with you today.
Good to be back, man.
Yeah, like I know that whenever I talk to you, like it gives me an excuse to say the word fuck.
Always here to help. Yeah. I know how it is for you academics. I'm here to help.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I try to not use that word too much in my podcast because it's a kid-friendly show, but it seems like you somehow write it in a way where you can't not use the word in that context.
Yeah. A lot of shows they'll do like everything is effed or everything is blank. But, you know, it doesn't have the same effect.
Right. I mean, everything is beeped is like, it doesn't pack the same punch. That's for sure. Well, this one is definitely going to be rated explicit on iTunes. So we already, within the first 2 minutes, have made that assurance, you know.
Excellent.
So I do want to ask you, you know, like, you talk about this uncomfortable truth that kind of pervades everything. Like, can you say like how you would define the people have defined it in different ways throughout the course of human history? How do you frame that?
I framed it. So to give kind of a more academic background of the uncomfortable truth, I've been greatly inspired by Ernest Becker's book, Denial of Death, and this idea that there's kind of this pervading terror of our own existence that underlies all human motivation. And it's, for me, the way I describe the uncomfortable truth in the book is a little bit more from like kind of a cosmic scale. It's not so much that we're going to die. It's more that knowing how big the universe is and how insignificant all of our individual actions are in the scale, like in compared to the scale of the universe, it's really, really difficult for anybody who is like, if you're being rational about it, to assume that your actions or your life has any meaning or significance whatsoever. And I think, you know, I think we all, you know, a friend of mine joked, he was like, oh yeah, that's like your stone dorm room conversation. And I'm like, yeah, I think we all have that conversation at some point, that realization that like, you know, oh my God, my life is so tiny and insignificant and it's terrifying, but we don't really talk about it. And we spend a lot of our life avoiding that fact. So I wanted to start the book by just getting that front and center, essentially.
Yeah, it does frame the whole book and the whole notion that everything is fucked. That's for sure. I can't help but like giggle every time I say the F word, though. Like, have you noticed that? Like, I'm not there yet where I can say it, you know, without giggling. I don't know what that is about my cultural conditioning that's doing that. But anyway, so yeah, Becker talked about, he put it as the rumble of panic. And that always really resonated with me. Like the rumble of panic that underlies everything we do. He was so dramatic, you know?
I know. I love it.
He's so dramatic, but brilliant, quite brilliant. I don't understand why everything that is like, whenever someone starts talking about like literally the most deep or the, you know, like the deepest, most profound existential issues, someone always is like, oh, that sounds like just pot speaking or something. Like, why is there a human need to kind of reduce or just like, do you know what I mean? It seems like it really, people want to cheapen the most profound things in life so that they, maybe is that so that they don't have to think about it themselves?
Yeah, it's funny because I noticed that when I was handing out, you know, giving this the draft to some of my friends, like a lot of people made that joke. And
is that a defense mechanism?
Yeah, it bugged me a little bit. And
it bugs me. It bugs me.
Yeah.
Someone said that to you.
Yeah, I didn't really think about it too much, but I think, yeah, maybe you're right. Like that is another form of avoidance. You know, it's like, you don't have to, you know, the section about the uncomfortable truth, one of the things I say is that this is a book that argues against nihilism But to argue against nihilism, you must start at nihilism. And I think it's just that is such an uncomfortable thing, especially for people, I guess, who have struggled with things like depression, and that, yeah, it's a defense mechanism. A way to avoid that is to just make light of it. Just be like, oh, yeah, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, we're smoking pot, dude.
Yeah. Well, you definitely face it head on, and I assume you didn't write your whole book while you were under the influence of marijuana.
So, no.
So you said some of these profound things, and it's possible to say them and think about them not under the influence of narcotics. So your book is quite interesting. It's two parts, and, you know, you kind of like, not bait and switch, that's not the right word, but like you read the first half and you're like, okay, these are the things, hope is important in the world today. All hope is lost. Everything's fucked. Here's the three things, you know, that we need for hope. And then there's like the second part that's kind of like the reveal of what the book is really about. And I didn't honestly see it coming. Like,
yeah.
I like didn't see it coming. And in this interview, I'm almost remiss to even talk about it because like, I don't want to like, it's like giving away a plot line of like the Avengers Endgame, right? Like,
yeah.
So let's first talk about the first half. And then if to reward the listeners who are still listening by the time we get to it, then we will do the grand reveal.
Okay.
But still hopefully whet their interest or appetite, I'm bad at metaphors, whatever, we're wetting to get them to really want to listen, to read the book.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So you say we're a culture in need of hope. So this is like in the beginning, like you make that statement. Why are we in a culture in need of hope? Why is that?
Well, I became very interested. I think like everybody, the events of 2016 kind of shook me a little bit, but it's funny. It's not just, you know, it's not Trump. Like I'm not a Trump fan, but for me, it went much beyond the election itself. I think 2016 felt like it broke our culture, like just the internet, the clickbait, the fake news, all the cyber warfare going on. It feels like that year was very much a turning point in terms of our cultural trust in each other. And in the media and in our institutions. And that really, really troubled me. And so I started doing a lot of research on, you know, why that was happening. And one of the things I came across that I found very interesting was something that's called the Easterlin paradox, which is that they find that wealthier countries and even wealthier neighborhoods or cities have greater amounts of suicide, mental health issues, depression, anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. And so it got me thinking about this idea of like, why is it if things are so, like we live at the best moment of human history by all sorts of measurements, yet it's by, you know, a lot of statistical measurements, we're angrier and more upset and more despondent than ever before. And then you go online, you go on Twitter for 10 minutes, and it seems like everybody is just angry constantly about everything. So that was my starting point. It's like, what? How do you describe this? And one of the interesting conclusions I came to, it's actually something I think Nassim Taleb argued in Anti-Fragile, is that he said that basically the better things get, the more difficult it is to be optimistic for the future because you have more to lose. Yeah, A, because you have more to lose, and B, because it becomes the definition of improvement itself becomes more complicated, you know? So it's like, if you're a subsistence society, you know, if you're like, I don't know, Kenya or something, it's like improvement's very simple. It's like, get people out of poverty, make sure people stop dying of disease. But like once you're Sweden or Japan, you know, or Canada, like it's actually very complicated to know what improvement is. It's a very contentious, complicated discussion. And that makes it difficult for people to have this hopeful outlook for the future or this optimistic vision of the future. And so that fascinated me, and it made me feel like that there seems to be something in the zeitgeist right now around that. I think there's something about the internet that complicates people's visions of hope, makes it difficult for them to know what to hope for, complicates it in ways that it wasn't complicated in previous generations. And so I wanted to explore that.
Yeah, I had Steven Pinker on my podcast a couple months ago, and we talked about this, and of course he's been banging that drum for a while that like, well, the world is good, you know, like everything's good, you know, like everybody calm the fuck down. but that does little, as I said to him, you know, on the podcast, like, okay, like, yeah, like statistically on average, you know, like that is like little assurance to those who are like really the bottom of like, you know, of structural systems and things.
Well, not even to the bottom. So I it's interesting. I address Pinker in chapter one, and I need to like put a preempt this by saying like I'm a total Pinker fanboy. I love his books.
Yeah.
And I think they're great, but I was very frustrated when I read Enlightenment Now because I felt like he kind of just brushed aside the questions of human well-being and, you know, like emotional well-being, I should say. He focuses very much on material and physical well-being. And in the one chapter that he kind of talked about in that book, he very briefly, I think he had maybe in a 500-page book, he had like three paragraphs that pointed out that, you know, yes, anxiety and depression are becoming larger issues. But then he said, well, if the price that we pay for living longer and being healthier is that we're more anxious, then that's probably worth it. And it's like, well, yeah, you know, it reminds me of the Big Lebowski. It's like, you're not wrong, Walter. You're just an asshole. Because it's...
that's great solace for the person who's like like depressed and suicidal. And it's like, you know, if that's the price you were going to pay, it's like...
You know, it's like there are a lot of like... you know, rich soccer moms and successful lawyers who are like really in bad places. And the worst thing about it, I think, is that a lot of people, and I know I experienced this myself because I come from a very privileged background and I have a very successful career. But when I go through those episodes where I feel depressed or I come close to the uncomfortable truth as I write it, it creates this sense you feel guilty about it. You're like, what's wrong with me? Like everything's great. Why do I feel this way? Mm. And so in some sense, it's like, again, it complicates.
That's so interesting. You're like, I'm privileged. I should have no right to be sad.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's so interesting. Yeah. And I think a lot of people do feel that way for sure.
But yeah, so I compare Pinker in my book. I call him, you know, like that, your uncle who's always wagging his finger and saying, when I was your age, you know, things were much worse. And it's like, well, yeah, you're right. But that doesn't make me feel any better about my issues.
Right. So yes, that's cool. And so this is the paradox of progress is what you refer to in your book. So let's move on to self-control, because I thought that was a really interesting framing of it, a little bit different than I see in the psychological literature, but who knows, maybe the psychological literature is wrong, maybe you're right, like, you know, like I really want to really get my head around this. You argue it's mostly an emotional, like a failure of self-control is mostly, in your view, an emotion issue, is that right?
Yes, because it's essentially the chapter is called Self-Control is an Illusion, and I basically make the argument that as a lot of the research shows that we're our actions are primarily motivated by our emotions, and then our rational part of our brain just justifies it afterwards. And the argument I make is essentially that the feeling of self-control is an illusion when our two brains are aligned, our emotional brain and our rational brain, and or, you know, Kahneman's system one, system two. And it's, but the problem is when they get unaligned, where it's like, rationally know I should go to the gym today, or I should like not eat this cake for breakfast, but I'm sitting there shoveling my face. That's when that illusion of self-control breaks down and it becomes very stressful and difficult for people. And the argument I make is that it when self-control breaks down consistently enough, it harms our ability to maintain hope. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if my hope for myself is that I get healthy this year, yet I'm sitting there shoveling my face every morning, it destroys that vision of hope and then, you know, brings me back to despair, essentially. Right.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Like, you're getting in your own way of your own potential for hope. But like, in a way, you're saying, like, we don't realize just how much we get in our own way of, you know, like, we always look outward for hope, right? I feel like that's like the default is like, I'm looking for hope. But like, we don't realize the things we do ourselves that you're limited there by doing that in the morning. Yeah. Or not, like you never go to the gym yet. You want to be hopeful that you're going to lose weight. Like,
Or even the people who, you know, it's people who, like, let's say you believe deeply in some sort of political, like environmentalism or something. And it's like, you draw a lot of hope from the environmental movement, yet you can't bring yourself to actually like get out the door and go do something. You know, it makes it difficult for us to maintain that vision. Like, it's not, it makes it difficult to experience that sense of fulfillment, you know, to achieve that meaning that we want in our lives. We feel disempowered. We feel out of control of our life. I mean, one thing that's fun about not being an academic is that I get to put my own creative spin on a lot of concepts, and I'm not held to, my feet aren't held to the fire of like, okay, go verify this. You know,
review. You're not being peer reviewed.
So it's, you know, and I don't think I would be great at that. I think, you know, my strength as a writer and as a thinker, I think is these creative, coming up with creative ways to view a lot of these concepts and see how they might relate to each other. Cool. So that's one of them for sure.
It's cool. Yeah, it's definitely cool. Yeah. I mean, self-control researchers, I mean, it's hotly debated, you know, the whole idea of like, is it like a muscle, you know, like ego depletion, you know, the more we try to restrain ourselves, we then eventually like cave and like fivefold, you know, oh, I went on the diet for 2 days, I'm a good person, I'm now going to eat 500 cookies at once. And then you like, it's like, we eventually cave the more we exert the self-control. And that, you know, so in a lot of ways, yeah, there is a strong emotional component for sure. And there's also a cognitive component of like, people who have really good self-control do seem to be good, though, using their, what you call the thinking mind to like override the emotional mind. So, but you see,
I think so. So I do see it differently. I mean, I see that as kind of just another remix of ego depletion. The point that I make is that people with, you know, a person that you and I would look at and say like, wow, that person has incredible self-discipline. My argument is that the reason they seem to have that self-discipline is that there is some sort of emotional satisfaction that they're deriving from it. Like, the reason it's hard for me to stop eating cake is that there's too much emotional satisfaction from it. You know, it's like you can will yourself to go to the gym for a week or maybe a month, but until you start enjoying it and until you experience the emotional benefits of it, it never,
until you engage the emotional brain is what you're saying.
Yeah. Exactly. And so like all the people I know who are just like machines, you know, up at 5 a.m. and doing pull-ups and shit, it's like, they love it. Like
Jocko Willink.
Some sick part.
You know Jocko?
Exactly.
Yeah, you know that guy?
Exactly.
You don't want to mess with that guy.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely not.
We're going to talk very fondly of him.
Yeah, it's funny. So I actually referenced him in the book. And
yeah, that's right, you do.
And I mentioned, because he has this whole thing. So actually, he's a great example, because he has this whole thing about, he said that when he was in Iraq, and this, I touch on this later in the book too, this idea of like narratives, constructing meaning with our narratives. He was in Iraq and he said that the story he would tell himself when he was out there was that if he got up at 4 a.m., he had an advantage over the enemy. And so that motivated him to get up at 4 a.m. You know, so like that's a perfect example of like leveraging your emotional brain to like build discipline for yourself. And the amazing thing about him is that when he came home, he still, that narrative still works for him. So it's like, he still gets up at 4 a.m. and is like, yeah, I'm up like 2 hours before everybody else. Like, this is why I'm going to kick their ass. And it's like, that's, it's the emotional benefit of that narrative that is like, keeps him doing it. So it's funny. I explain that in the book and then I reference him. And when I was sitting there like explaining, I was like, yeah, even though this narrative is totally untrue. And as soon as I wrote that, I'm like, oh God, I hope he doesn't kick my ass.
Yeah, yeah, you gotta really be careful, because he'll kick your ass at like while you're still sleeping, like 5:30 in the morning.
Exactly. I would be just going to bed from a night And he'll be getting up.
He'll be getting up. Yeah. I mean, he's up while everyone else in the world is sleeping. So it's like, yeah. Okay, cool. It's just such an interesting twist. And I'm like, so should I completely flip the way I've been thinking about this? Because I wrote a tweet that got a lot of likes, so it's got to be true. about 6 months ago, I said, like, one of the greatest realizations of me is that I don't have to be a slave to my emotions. Like, I'm allowed to, like, listen to the signals and say, nah, I'm good. And, you know, that got a lot of likes sort of thing. And I'm paraphrasing myself, so I think it was more eloquent what I actually wrote than what I just said. But anyway, is that at odds with what you're saying? Is it, like, are you almost saying, like, it's not that we should, like, really train ourselves to not be so, like, there's one view where I'm saying, like, don't be so reactive to what your emotions are telling you, like, and have the freedom to choose what you want to act on and what you don't. But are you saying, like, almost retrain, maybe we can synthesize both views, retrain your emotional brain to make it more likely you'll do the things you want to do. But for the things we don't want to do, like, learn to put that space through mindfulness. Like, is that an integration of both of our views?
I think so. Like, I don't think we are contradictory. I mean, one thing I talk about in the book is that I think ultimately the job of the logical side of our brain is to challenge our emotional impulses. And exactly like you said, is to feel it and say, like, that's not necessarily destiny. Just because I feel something doesn't mean it's necessarily destiny. But I don't think that goes, like, that is necessary but not sufficient for behavioral change, for long-term behavioral change. I think the second step is that you then need to construct some sort of meaning around that emotion that will produce, that will change how you feel about a situation going into the future. So the silly analogy that I use is that, you know, you have two brains, they're bad at talking to each other, and you have to, because they speak different languages, and you have to, like, you have to train yourself to translate each one to the other. So to go back to the gym, you know, the gym example, since it's just such a simple and ubiquitous example, it's, you know, if I wake up and I really don't feel like going, the job of my thinking brain is to start kind of bargaining and trying on different stories of meaning for my feeling brain. So I might say, like, so if the story I'm telling myself is like, you know, I'm a worthless piece of crap if I don't go work out, that's not going to inspire a whole lot of motivation. Or at least for me, for some people it might. But then maybe if I'm like, well, how about this? How about you just put your shoes on and just go there and just walk on a treadmill? Like, that's easy. Anybody can do that. How does that feel? And then my feeling brain might be like, oh, well, yeah, that feels all right. And then so then you do that. And then once you're actually at the gym, and you're like, well, crap, there's all these weights everywhere, I might as well, like, pick something up. It becomes much easier. And so there's, like, this interplay that happens between both sides of our brains. And it's about, like, learning how to just communicate with yourself almost.
I like that.
Effectively.
Integrate. Yeah. Integrate both brains. Wow.
Yes, sir.
I like it. So you you found some of Newton's unpublished writings on emotions, and I never seen those before. I didn't know that I didn't realize he had any emotions himself.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, he's a very thinking kind of guy.
He was.
But let's talk about one. For every action, there's an equal and opposite emotional reaction. So what does that mean?
Is that basically it's. Without going too deep into it, that basically it's emotions are results of experiences, you know. So it's perceived experiences, you know. So it's anything that you feel, it's because of some perception or some experience that's occurred to you. So it's kind of just a simple to kind of give context to the whole Newton thing. I've long been very, very fascinated with Newton, and I've wanted to write about him for a long time because, you know, for how brilliant he was just such an emotionally, like, miserable, awful person. And he also just had this incredibly traumatic childhood and upbringing. And I just thought, I always found that, like, so fascinating about him. And so I wrote kind of a playful, one of the chapters in the book is like, it's historical fiction. I call him Emo Newton. So you know, like the real Newton was abandoned by his parents and was abused and bullied as a child growing up and was an outcast. And he just became this very miserable, unhappy kid. And I was like, yeah, he's like an emo kid. You know, he's like this kid who like puts on makeup and like wears black trench coats and stuff like that. So I kind of reimagined him as this emo version of himself who becomes obsessed with calculating and chronicling, like finding ways to measure objectively all human behavior. And then he comes up with Newton's laws of emotion.
I just got it.
I
didn't realize that. Yeah, the emo part, emotion. That's so clever. Yeah. That's clever. Yeah.
And so then the three laws are I kind of use as a basis. You know, so in chapter two about self-control, I talk about how self-control is a perception that it's a perceptual experience that we have when our two brains are aligned, when we're able to align our thoughts with our emotions. And then chapter three is kind of using the Newton's laws of emotion to explain the mechanics of our emotional brain, like what causes us to feel things and to, you know, why trauma messes us up and where our values come from and things like that.
Yeah, in fact, you define growth as reprioritization, the reprioritization of one's values hierarchy in an optimal way. I thought that was a really clever definition of growth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So that what would I say? I would say that's certainly a indication that you're growing. Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
How would you define growth?
Oh, you Vaismir. Well, I mean,
do we need another podcast?
Yeah, yeah. I think, and we need to be under the influence of marijuana. No, I'm joking. Everybody, calm down. Calm down, mom. I know you listen to my podcast. Calm down. Okay. Yeah, let's focus on you. So, yeah, the reprioritization of one's value hierarchy in optimal way. It's very clever. I would say that's definitely one indication of growth. I think there are multiple indications.
Sure.
You know, I think another indication is that you're making some sort of contribution to in some way outside of yourself, you know?
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to necessarily be like Gandhi, you know, like people put so much pressure on people that, like, I see like crazy shit on the internet that I just like, no, that can't be right. Like, they're like, the only life that's worth, and they'll quote Einstein, right? And Einstein never said it, but they'll say like, you know, the only life worth living the only life worth living is the one where you're like, you know, always giving to others or whatever. It's like, that's, I don't know about that. Like, do we really want to just a priori like judge what a life worth living is or not? Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that just doesn't feel right to me. But anyway.
Yeah.
So let's move on. Let's talk about identity. So Newton's thoughts on identity that were unpublished, or emo Newton, are so. Yeah. Your identity will stay your identity until a new experience acts against it. So can you give an example of that?
So basically our emotion. So here's kind of the step-by-step summary of what I talk about is that experiences happen. And then based on how much pain that experience causes or how much pain that experience alleviates, we will have a positive or negative emotional reaction to it. And then from there, it's if those emotions persist over a certain amount of time, we construct a narrative around them to justify them. So it's like if I'm, let's say I'm a kid and I'm being beat up and abused, at some point, my thinking brain has to step in and create a narrative that justifies those feelings of pain. And usually, typically, very young children, the narrative they construct is that I'm a horrible person and I deserve this. These narratives are always constructed around deserving, what you deserve, what you don't deserve.
Yeah, the fairy tales are very much about that, right? Yeah. The cautionary tales, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah. And so these narratives kind of start accumulating like a ball of yarn, you know, throughout our lives. And it's like the earlier the narrative was put in, it's like deeper inside the ball of yarn, the more you have to unspool it to kind of get to it. And it's that ball of yarn, that network of narratives that we construct about ourselves and what we deserve, what we don't deserve, is what I call our identity. It's our self-definition. And and then we psychologically, I think it's called like self-preservation or I don't remember. But there's some model out there that talks about how we seek to, that identity then also becomes something that we protect and try to keep coherent through future experiences. So our, it biases our perceptions and our impulses and stuff going into the future. It's basically my take on, I guess you could almost call it like just development, you know, psychological development, but with a lot of focus on emotions and narratives.
But give me like a concrete example of like, so my identity is X and I really think it's my identity until, and then give me an example of an experience that acts against it. Like, I just want to really wrap my head around that.
So for instance, you know, a huge component of my identity is that I'm a writer and an author. And I could even say that I am a big part of my identity is that I'm a successful author. Now let's say this book comes out and sells like 20 copies. Everybody hates it.
You still wrote a best-selling book though before this one.
Yes, but that will conflict with my identity. It'll cause a lot of internal dissonance in terms of how I understand myself. Because it's like right now I'm like, yeah, I'm big Mr. Best-selling author. And then it's like next book comes out and bombs. Then that creates a lot of dissonance that I have to sort out. It'll create a lot of negative emotions that I need to sort out and like rewrite new narratives for.
You could have just avoided that by just never writing another book ever again. And just, you would assure yourself that you'd die a best-selling author.
Well, that's, you know, that we call that the J.D. Salinger strategy. you know, my preferred approach is to just try to not adopt that identity in the first place. It's just something that, and this kind of comes from my Buddhist background, but it's, I try to hold, and I think I talk about this in Subtle Art, is like always hold your identity lightly.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like I write books and those books have sometimes perform well, but that's not necessarily who I am.
Yeah.
And so it's like the lighter I hold that, the less susceptible I am to just being bulldozed over by the world.
Yeah, I really like that. I have Buddhist inclinations as well, so I really resonate with that. And even the way you talked about narcissism, and you correctly identified, but you didn't call by the psychological clinical names vulnerable and grandiose, but you still point out there's this fragile form of narcissism, this more grandiose form, but you said they both are similar in a lot of ways, you know, and kind of stem, yeah, like they're both unnecessary, you know? You know, like if you always like go around the world thinking you're like the greatest, you're bound to have a blow to your ego at some point that'll make you fall way down. But if you always walk around saying you're vulnerable and deserving of special attention, you're bound to constantly be disappointed as well, right? So
yeah, they're both, whether you think you're better than everybody or worse than everybody, you're still assuming that you're different than everybody.
That's right. I love it. Okay. Well, let's move on. Well, okay, before we get to part two, one more question before part two. How do you start your own religion? So so basically, do we just sum it all up by saying sell hope to the hopeless? Like, that's like the key thing, right?
I think that's definitely step one.
Yeah, so is that going to like piss off someone? Like, are there going to be like religious like zealots? Like gurus or whatever read your book? They're like, don't say my secret. Don't, you know, like you're gonna hurt business for me.
Well, I think maybe the most, to use your research, maybe the most extreme dark triads would have thought through their methods enough to have that reaction. But I think most kind of like cultish religious tendencies, like I guess part of the argument I make in that chapter is that it's cultish tendencies are like a natural part of our nature. And it's not, you know, people like David Koresh or whoever, like it's not, they're not these super evil, bad geniuses. As much as we want to believe that, it's this cultish tendency exists within all of us, and our religiosity, our tendency towards religious behavior is pretty ubiquitous. And it's not just limited to like the traditional religions. You know, one thing I found super interesting when I was researching this book was that, and this is just totally a connection I kind of made on myself, I don't think I've seen any research explicitly talk about this, but there, you know, everybody's seen the data about how the world is becoming less religious and how fewer people are going to church and more people are atheist or agnostic. And what's hold on just a second. Let me go in the other room.
Sure. Well, I'm getting like am I getting a tour of your house right now?
No, I'm in the Bahamas, dude.
What? You're in the Bahamas right now?
Dude, life is crazy.
Oh my gosh. Is he like hanging out with Will Smith or something?
I am.
Can I not edit out that whole interlude from the interview? Yeah,
do whatever you want, man. It's your show. So religiosity. Religion. So yeah. One thing I can't. Yeah, my research is religiosity has been declining for decades now, and one thing I find fascinating is that during this, even though fewer people are going to church than ever before, I think as a culture, our approaches to politics is becoming much more religious. Our approach to corporations, if you look at brands like Apple and Nike, it's they're almost intentionally poking at kind of the religious responses among their consumers. Celebrity culture is becoming much more religious. So I think it's not that religiosity is disappearing. There's like a weird transfer going on where instead of worshiping God, we're finding all these other things to be worshiping.
Yeah. Yeah. Not just worshiping, but just paying attention to like distractions and things.
Yeah.
Cool. So let's open the Pandora's box of part two of your book.
Yeah.
You see what I did? You see what I did there?
Okay. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Was that nice? Okay. So correct me if I'm wrong, but like, I don't want to like say things are even more clever than even you meant them to be, but like, I thought it was really clever that like, hope is analogous to the idea that God is dead. Is that right? Did I make that connection correct? Did you think about that? Like Nietzsche's pronouncement, God is dead, is analogous to like you coming off your mountain and saying my realization here in part two is actually hope is actually fucked.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Yeah.
I don't think that was conscious.
Okay.
You know, so it's funny.
We can use that now in your marketing materials.
Okay. I'll send you your commission check. Yeah,
the new Nietzsche, that's like the modern day announcement, you know?
Yeah. Well, so it's funny because, so I didn't put that together, but I will tell you, so the whole last chapter of part one is almost like an ode to Nietzsche.
Yeah.
And that wasn't intended at all when I started writing the book. Mm-hmm. Initially, I just wanted to write like a small section about him talking about like the God is dead thing. And it was funny when I started researching him, I just became so fucking, I don't know what it was, but it was, I just got sucked away and like fell in love with the guy. I read a bunch of biographies by him and then read a bunch of his books, and I found him so relevant and insightful for what I feel the world is going through today. And so I ended up, that whole chapter is basically kind of about him, about his ideas, and then also just applying them to the world today. But maybe that's why he resonated with me so much. Maybe I was having my own God is dead moment.
Yeah. I think that you did have a God is dead moment, and there's such a contrast to, you know, kind of like, it's almost like you had hope in hope in part one. You're like, you know, hope is lost, and you know, here's like the ways that we can genuinely restore hope. But then you're like, no, that's a worthless project. You know, I take it back. I give up hope in hope. So tell us a little bit why hope is destructive. And this, and now the second part of this interview is going to have a different tone.
Sure. So one of the things that I did, so I open up the book with a Holocaust story. And I did that for a few reasons. One is I feel like culturally the Holocaust is like the most kind of universally acknowledged evil thing that has happened in Western culture in the last 100 years, 200 years. And second, I did that because I also wanted to, you know, for people who watch 20 cable news all day or sit on Twitter all day, like I think it was useful to be like, hey, wake up call, shit's not that bad. Here is it getting, this is how it could be. This is how it's been in the past. This is how bad it's been in the past. And so I, you know, World War II stories, Holocaust stories, they're as a writer, they're always great because it's one of the few major things in our history that we seem to be unanimous about. And of course, I write it as, you know, the classic, you know, Nazis are awful and evil and good guys win. You know, so I write it as a classic, you know, good guys win over evil. And I tell a story about a guy who was able to maintain hope and like against impossible odds. The big switcheroo, or I guess as you would say, the grand reveal that comes in chapter 5 is that I make the point that it's hope is not, didn't just help the Allies win World War II. Hope is also the reason that the Nazis tried to create a pure race. Hope is the reason why communists tried to foment a worldwide revolution. Hope is not necessarily good. I would actually say hope is neutral. And it's like the thing I compare it to is love, is that we tend to always assume that love is good, but love can also be the most painful and damaging thing in our life. It can be the best thing in our life, most rewarding thing in our life, but it can also be the most painful and damaging thing in our life. And I think hope is the same thing on a cultural scale. Mm-hmm. Hope is, it's necessary. It's kind of, it is a fundamental part of our psychological mechanism, but it's also, if we're not careful, it can be incredibly destructive. And the paradox that I point out is that hope, ultimately, even though when things get fucked, we always look for hope. I point out that hope needs something to be fucked. If nothing was fucked, we would have to create something being fucked in order to maintain our hope. And so in that sense, hope necessitates some form of destruction or contradiction. You know, there's a quote, I think I actually use this quote in Subtle Art. There's a quote I love, and I think it comes from a Spanish artist, and he said that when the human mind is presented with no problems, it sets about creating them for itself, or something like that. And so then that kind of leads into part two. It's like, all right, if hope necessitates some degree of conflict and destruction, what is the least destructive or damaging form of hope?
Well, this is so interesting because in a way we were saying like the moment we feel content, all hope is lost.
Yeah, right.
Like basically that's what you're saying. That's like the ergo, you know, if you finish the proof, the math proof, that's yeah. What you're saying. It's such an interesting way of thinking about everything. It really is Buddhist. It really is Buddhist at the end of the day. It's like, yeah. It's like being versus doing, right? Being like, just like finding contentment in the current moment is good enough. Yeah. Like you don't, like in a way, like if hope is, it's tricky because you don't want to say if hope is lost, then that's an indication that things are good. No, because that doesn't follow logically either, because like There are obviously people living in squalor, right? Like there are people who like hope is something that would keep them going to wanting to be able to get out of bed. Like, you know, let's say you're in a war-torn society, people are dying all around you. Like certainly you don't want hope to be lost in that situation, right?
But what's interesting is my argument is that hope is much easier to find in those situations. So for instance, if you're living in squalor, it's a very simple question what to hope for, to not be in squalor. You know, it's to get enough food to eat, get enough money to like go somewhere better. When everything is comfortable, you know, when you're sitting in a recliner with 500 channels, right, with air conditioning on, with, you know, a simple service sector job, with your phone that has more information on it than humanity's ever known, it's actually very, very difficult to know what to hope for.
Yeah.
And you actually have to go find it yourself. And the problem is that the destructive aspect of hope is extremely subtle. You know, hope, it's like love. Love feels so good that when you start dating that awful person, you don't realize, you justify everything to yourself. You don't realize what you're doing because it feels so good. And I think it's the same thing with hope. I think we get so swept up in this vision of a better world, a better life, that we aren't aware of the destructive underbelly of our hopes. And so when society becomes very comfortable and everything becomes convenient and we become responsible for finding hope for ourselves, I think we get led into some very dangerous and very dark places without realizing it.
It's really, a really, really thought-provoking idea, and I love those kinds of ideas because it was really cool to read your book, and I did, definitely had lots of moments of like, huh, do I need to flip the script of how I've been thinking about things? So thank you. I just want to thank you, first of all.
Yeah.
That's what a good book should do, right?
That's the goal.
Yeah. Okay. So you talk about the one rule for life. Well, people love rules. And if you say there's only one rule, then the people love that even more. So what is the one rule for life?
I zeroed in on Kant's formula of humanity. And I was super happy to see it featured in your research. And it's funny too, because it's, you know, some of the people that I know who are have read philosophy or whatever, you know, Kant's moral philosophy is, it's kind of a joke in some circles. And I think there's a lot of aspects of it that are unreasonable or a little bit ridiculous, but I was in kind of a dark place a couple of years ago. I guess you could say I didn't know what to hope for. Part of the inspiration of this book is I didn't know what to hope for.
Mm.
And I started
Depressed. Were you depressed?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dude, subtle. So, okay. So selling like 3 million copies of your book, like
I can't even imagine that. First of all,
first of all, public service announcement. I'm not complaining about anything. I'm totally grateful. It's been incredible. I wouldn't take a single second back, but you know, one thing that I told some people is that, you know, I spent pretty much my entire adult life wanting to be a best-selling author and working towards that. Like, it was my dream. It was the thing that got me up in the morning. And in my mind, it was like, okay, I'm going to write books. And over the course of like 20 years of really hard work, you know, I'm going to knock out some of these goals and achieve these things. And, you know, by the time I'm 50 or 60, I'm going to have like a really successful writing career. And then Subtle Art comes out and it's like, all of those goals are accomplished within 2 months, you know? So it's like the things that I've been dreaming that I'm like, okay, this is going to define my life for decades. They're done, you know? And I think
all hope is lost.
Yeah. So here's one thing that people never talk about is that the most surefire way to have no dreams is to accomplish them. Like, people don't realize that. And it's funny because I went through this like very malaise, like, and again, it was one of those things that I was feeling depressed. And the whole time I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with me? Like, I'm not,
right.
This is supposed to be the best moment of my life.
Yeah.
Like, why am I sitting around in pajamas playing Zelda 12 hours a day?
Wait,
like,
you play Zelda?
Oh, dude,
we should talk about that. We should talk about that another time. We'll do a podcast. Can we do a podcast chat just on Zelda?
Just on Zelda.
Go on.
I spent the better part of a year just kind of spun out, not knowing why. And then eventually, you know, I'm friends with a number of people in the startup world here in New York. And it was funny because I started kind of talking to some friends about this, about what I was feeling, what was going on. And my startup friends were like, oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, they're like, that's normal, right? Like, that happens to everybody. Right. You know, you've got this company, you work like 80 hours a week for 6 years, and then you exit, make a bunch of money. And you know, a friend of mine who's had a couple successful exits, he told me, he's like, yeah, nothing is worse. He's like, nothing makes me more depressed than like exiting a company that I put all of my hopes and dreams in for years and years and years. So I was like, wow, that's so crazy. Like, that's actually, you know, and then that combined with all the 2016 stuff, it got me thinking about like, what is it, this hope, this mechanism inside of us that we need something, some vision of the future that we can look forward to. So anyway, one of the things during that period, one of the things that kind of pulled me out of it, I started reading philosophy again. I hadn't read it since college. Mm. I'd always been really interested in Kant's work, but I had never really like dived into it.
Did you understand it? Did you really understand like Critique of Pure Reason?
I maybe understood half of it.
It's really rigorous.
It's insanely rigorous. I love Kant. Like, that was actually a very surprising thing, is that I found a lot of joy in the just the beauty and the precision of his thinking.
Yeah.
And then I read the Groundworks, the Metaphysics of Morals, and where he introduces the categorical imperative and the formula of humanity. And, you know, it's tons of criticisms of his moral philosophy. But like when you're just reading that little book, it's like about 100 pages, the logic within it feels so airtight. Like it's so airtight. And you're like, wow, this guy is like nailed it. It was a really revelatory experience for me. And then the formula of humanity in particular, because I've written, you know, so as you know, my background years and years ago, like the first thing I wrote about was like dating relationships, basically social interactions. And one of the things that I've written about forever is acting unconditionally, you know, not treating people in a transactional manner, not being manipulative, enforcing strong boundaries, uncompromising honesty. And so when I got to the part about Kant's formula of humanity, I mean, it's like he basically summed up 5 years of my dating relationship, social interaction writing in like a single sentence. And I was like, holy shit, man, this guy's legit. Kant is legit. Yeah, but it was so inspiring for me. It was really, really inspiring for me.
Something similar happened to me too. It's so funny.
Really?
When we were trying to think of what's the opposite of the dark triad, and we're like, what's the opposite of Machiavellianism? And then my colleague David Eden, like, wait, that's Kantianism. And it was like, it just snapped into place, you know? Because they're, No, it's so cool that you resonate with that. I resonate with that. Like, I wonder what that says about us or people what resonate with that. I hope it's a good thing that we resonate with that.
I think, like, what I love about it too, the whole means and ends thing, like, it just seems like such a fundamental, like, it doesn't seem arbitrary.
Right.
It seems like if you were able to dig into a brain and see how it like thinks about other humans, you would be able to like parse out, you know, what a means looks like and what an ends looks like. You know, it seems like such a fundamental part of our cognitive process. And I think he talked about that in Critique of Pure Reason, how it's like everything we think in sequences. It's like this leads to this leads to this. And and so Kant very rationally decided that the basis of morality is to never have a human only be a link in that causal chain, always have them be the end of the causal chain. And it's just so elegant and profound and logical that I found a lot of inspiration in it.
Yeah. So I, not to be like really nerdy, but I was familiar with it as his second formulation of his categorical imperative. Does he actually, did you come up with the phrase, his formula of humanity? Does he use the phrase formula of humanity?
He does.
Oh, that's so cool.
He does. He doesn't use it exactly formula of humanity, but I think he calls it, it's like the formulation of human ends or something like that. But I think it got kind of summarized as formula of humanity since then.
I love it. I love. I'm going to totally at cocktail parties refer to it as his formula of humanity now, as opposed to his second formulation of his categorical imperative.
It's a little bit catchier.
Yeah, like in our scientific paper on the light versus dark triad, we refer to it, you know, as the second blah blah blah. But I was like, man, I wish we just called it the formula of humanity. That would have made a sexier paper. But yeah. So will you tell me how I can grow up?
Yeah. So one thing I've been interested in for a long time has been, I would actually say, you know, kind of my gateway drug to psychology was developmental psychology, like reading about Piaget and Kohlberg and those guys. And Robert Keegan in particular is like, I find those models so fascinating. I have no idea how much empirical data they have behind them or how strong or flimsy that data is, but I've just always found it incredibly fascinating. And I've just kind of, it's been something I've stuff I've read for fun on and off over the years. And one thing that I found, you know, there's a lot of commonalities that people have in stages in terms of like how they think about themselves, how they construct their own identity, how they relate that identity to the world, and then how they kind of understand the world itself. And it was interesting because the formula of humanity, I realized, was if you look at like Kohlberg's theories of moral development, it's the formula of humanity is kind of the end point that, you know, if you think about it like a young child, pretty much all the young children are like little narcissists, tyrants. They're all like me, me, me. They have no conception of other children, and you have to teach them both, you know, through rewards, but also through punishments, you know, to share, to consider others, to, and then as they grow older, to consider society at large, or their, you know, understand that there are consequences for their actions and all this stuff. And I just kind of, you know, in all the developmental reading that I did, I saw that there was kind of an arrow pointing towards an understanding of self and other in terms of the formula of humanity, of never treating oneself as merely a means, only as an ends, and never treating others merely as a means. And that was just an really exciting connection I made myself, or, you know, I'm sure there's somebody else has made it somewhere, but, and so fuck it. It's my book. this is how I'm defining growth.
It's great. No, it's really good. It's good. I like the idea of like also saying like not treating your own self, you know, like being kind to yourself, yeah, and like unconditionally loving yourself in a certain sense, what you're saying.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that you condone everything about yourself. It's different. But
what's interesting too is that if you look at things that, you know, you would call unhealthy, you know, something like say alcoholism or even lying to yourself, those are situations where you're treating yourself as a means to some other end. So something like, you know, addiction, like substance abuse, you're treating yourself as a means to the end of, you know, blind, pointless pleasure. You're harming your identity and your physical body for the sake of experiencing some kind of synthetic form of pleasure. And as you know, Kant's whole thing was, he said that it's happiness doesn't matter. You know, it's happiness is besides the point, is what he would say, is he said that it's about, it's acting in such a way that you promote greater consciousness, greater rational consciousness. And so to do things that harm your rational consciousness, that harm your identity, that harm your physical body in pursuit of empty pleasure is like almost by definition treating yourself
a means to an end. No, it's a really brilliant connection. Yeah. I see it. I can see it so clearly. It's so cool. Yeah, like what a great like just principle, just like for everything you do in your life. It's easier said than done sometimes when that cookie, you know,
like, where's that cookie?
I'm looking for my favorite cookie. Yeah, just throw it away, like tie yourself to the mast. But it's really cool. I really like that, and I hope our listeners really get it too. I really do hope my listeners, like, you know, understand just how profound that really is as a way of living one's life. So, you know, this might be a little bit controversial territory, but politics. You say, quote, and I'm almost nervous to quote this, but you say political extremists, because they're intractable and impossible to bargain with, are by definition childish. They're a bunch of fucking babies. Now, here's the thing. I want to be, you know, almost everyone agrees with that when you talk about the far right. You know, it's like, yeah, Nazis, you know, alt-right, yeah, babies. But it seems more controversial to say that about the far left. Would you agree with that?
Well, that's because you and I live in New York and you're a professor.
You know,
I'm serious though.
Yeah, I think, okay, there's truth there.
But I think this is an important point, and it was actually a very important thing for me while writing this book. My politics lean left. I wouldn't consider myself like far left, but I'm definitely a lefty. And one thing that surprised me when Subtle Art came out and it became so popular is I started getting invited onto right-wing talk shows and right-wing blogs and media. And it was funny because, you know, so I did all the left-wing interviews and stuff that I kind of expected, interviews with professors and whatnot. And we'd get on and they're like, yeah, man, you know, it's, people are entitled in this country. They want their way or the highway. You know, entitlement was a big theme in Subtle Art. And, responsibility was another big theme. And I kind of wrote that book the book itself is apolitical, yeah, but I wrote that book and I was thinking about that stuff when I wrote it. And then what surprised me is that I started going on all these right-wing shows and media, and they're like, well, yeah, it's those damn liberals. They're just entitled. They're taking no responsibility for themselves. I was like, wait, what?
In retrospect, you wrote the Republican Manifesto. Did you not know that? You're like, in retrospect.
Yeah. So it was crazy because both sides read their own, you know, it was like a template that both sides kind of projected the other side into. And so I wanted to write this book in such a way that I wanted to talk about politics and political polarization and extremism, but I wanted to be very careful to talk about it in such a way that both sides would be able to see themselves, see the other side, and just see the dynamics at play, because everything's becoming politicized today. So when you say that, when you say, well, it's easy to see that about the right wing, I guarantee you, well, I've actually already had one interview where somebody said the exact same thing about the left, you know, and I'm going to go on Fox News in a week or two. So it's, you know, my goal, you know, we could argue which side's worse and, you know, whatever. And I agree the extremism is happening in different places and in different ways and to different degrees. But it's like, if you go to some other countries, like if you go to like Australia, or there's like a much larger left wing extremist component that's going on. So yeah, I wanted to write it. I wanted to get out of the America, US centric bubble, because I see extremism is happening all over the world in different capacities.
Yeah, and that recent study come out showing that the left wing authoritarianism does exist. You know, yeah. We tend to think of it, authoritarianism, only as a right wing phenomenon, but people, psychologists have started to quantify that, you know, there's about just as many left wing authoritarians as well. So what is the difference between what's the difference between pound fake freedom and no pound real freedom? Because real freedom doesn't involve a hashtag, right? Is that the point you're making?
Scott, like, where's your Twitter game? It's hashtag fake freedom.
Oh, you're right. Oh my God, that's so embarrassing. That is so embarrassing. Okay. What's the difference? Let me start that over. What's the difference between hashtag fake freedom and no hashtag real freedom?
Oh man, you should definitely keep that in.
Oh no, I'm gonna keep it in. No, I'm done. I will keep that in. Yeah, it'll show my age or whatever.
Well, you gotta up your Twitter game, Scott. It's it's
sounds
so
horrifying.
Hashtag fake freedom is I guess it's me poking fun at hashtag fake news.
Yeah,
but my argument, you know, I have a chapter towards the end of the book that. I make the argument that we need to redefine our understanding of freedom. I think for most of human civilization, we've lived in a state of scarcity. And so the assumption that more is always better has held true. And I think today we're seeing that now, today is kind of the first day, the last generation or so. It's like the first time in human history that we are exposed to far more information than we can ever process. We're exposed to far more people than we can ever know intimately or care about. We're exposed to, you know, far more opportunities to buy shit and to waste, destroy the environment.
Yeah, it's true.
And so I think I make the argument that we've hit a inflection point, where that assumption of more is always better is no longer true. And I think that the new definition of freedom is going to be people who are able to limit their own consumption effectively, who are be able to focus their attention and their experiences based on their values. Because the other thing that's happening too is just that media and marketing are getting so good, they're literally like hijacking our attention away from us. And so I try to argue that the new definition of freedom is self-limitation. Is deciding where you're going to draw the boundaries in your experience, in your existence, and sticking to them.
Is that similar to commitment? Is that basically, yes. Synonymous? Do you kind of use them synonymously in a way? Well, they're not synonymous. Like they're correlated statistically significant with each other.
I think commitment is maybe a little bit it's a context driven. So, you know, like I make a commitment to my wife, I make a commitment to my career. And what that means is that I'm blocking out, you know, I'm not seeing other women and I'm not like trying to like, you know, do a Broadway play. Like it's, I'm focused on this one thing. And so, I think you could, what I'm talking about, you know, I think we just need to apply that same dynamic to, in a lot of other areas of our lives of like information sources, people that we interact with or care about, it's activities we participate in, stuff we buy, things like that.
So what do you do, say, when like, I have a friend, David Epstein, who wrote a, just recently wrote a cool book on generalists. And that is a way, a potential way of being, you know, not necessarily, like there's kind of different ways of living one's life well, I think, you know, you can be kind of this Cal Newport, like deep work obsessed person, you know, or you can be more of this, like, I have a diversity of interests. I have just, I just like embracing life in all of its glory. And if that involves 500 women or 500, you know, iPads or, you know, like, I'm just like, I want all the things to experience all the things. Now, you're not saying like one way of living one's life is universally, objectively better than another, are you? Is there a way of like, maybe you can be a generalist and still have commitments? Maybe that's also a false dichotomy?
I would say it is. I see it as a false dichotomy. Like you can be interested in a lot of different things, but you still need to be very focused on how you experience those things.
I like that.
And committed to how you experience those things. So you can have 10 hobbies, but you also have to be like conscious of the time you're setting aside for them, not getting distracted by, you know, all this other crap, not sitting there scrolling through your social media 2 hours a day. Like it's, I think, you know, what I'm arguing against is basically not succumbing to an autopilot based in abundance. Like it's just, I think today the technology has created an environment today where we tend to fall into autopilot, not because we're doing the same thing. It's because there's just so much different stuff that's being thrown at us that it's so easy to just sit there and kind of like go through it for hours and hours on end. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. I really like that. I mean, like, it's kind of like you have monogamy, but people are making polyamory work in the sense that they're rationally trying to figure out, how can I do this in a way that doesn't hurt anyone in the relationship, but still has love and depth? So,
yes,
I guess I'm making it a polyamory analogy to like the world at large.
Sure. And I would even argue that in polyamory, they're still making a commitment. It's just they're not making a commitment to monogamy. They're making a commitment to, say, intimacy, or they're making a commitment to honesty.
That's right.
And that's totally reasonable. Yep. It's, I think the, what I'm arguing against is this idea that you can like just compulsively sit on Twitter and go on 20 dates a week and think that like you're going to get any value out of that and think that that's freedom. That's not freedom. That's compulsion. You know, it's the, that's by definition, the opposite of freedom.
I agree.
So,
and the existentialists would agree, and the humanistic psychologists would agree, and anyone who's sensible would agree with that.
Anyone who's right would agree.
Anyone knows what they're talking about. Okay. Second to last question, and then you'll like my last question. Second to last question. Why are we bad algorithms, and why should we not fear AI so much as we do?
So this was just kind of a fun, I wanted to wrap up the book with a discussion of AI, because I feel like, you know, we're all so caught up in like, you know, impeach Trump or, you know, all this little stuff that's kind of going on. And I feel like we're not even, there's this tidal wave that's approaching that is going to render a lot of what we understand as society and culture, like just completely irrelevant. And that's AI. And so I kind of have fun with it. You know, there's a lot of AI alarmists out there. I'm definitely not one of them. There's a lot of AI utopians out there who think that we're all going to become a single consciousness and live in, you know, perfect happiness and pleasure for all eternity. That's not me either. I guess the point that I make is that because our minds construct meaning in terms of these hope conflict narratives, we are very limited in our understanding of the world. And so I argue that people who see AI as this destructive thing that's going to wipe out humanity or fish with toothpicks or whatever, they're just projecting their own human understanding of the universe onto this new... Yeah,
what they would do if they were an AI robot.
Exactly. And I even point out, you know, I say, like, ethically speaking, like, we're throwing rocks in a glass house here. Like, it's like, there are five, I run through all these statistics of, like, there's 5 genocides occurring in the world today. You know, there's, like, I think 700 million people who are starving. You know, it's like, who are we to say that, like, AI is going to be this horrible evil that's going to destroy everything? And then the other point I make is, you know, I think the techno-utopias are kind of, they're just on the other side of the same coin. They're projecting the same way people used to project, you know, used to say, like, God is going to save us or Jesus is going to come save us or whoever. You know, I think people are just saying, oh, AI is going to come save us and everything's going to be happy. We're going to live in heaven. The point I make is that AI is going to be, once they surpass our intelligence, we're literally not going to be able to understand. The analogy I use is that it's our relationship with AI is like trying to play chess with your dog. Like, it doesn't matter how smart your dog is, like, they're not going to be able to play chess with you. So, you know, AI is going to come and we're not even going to understand what's happening or why it's happening. And I think that's okay. I'm at peace with that. And because again, and I think this is what's distinguished me in the self-help industry is that I'm kind of a pessimist about human nature. I think humans, you know, we kind of suck. We're bad algorithms. We're bad. We are inefficient information processors. We are.
Hey, speak for yourself, man.
we're evolved not for truth or, you know, reduction of suffering. We evolve for survival and reproduction. And I think AI will be some sort of sentient thing that exists that will be optimized for information processing and rationality. And I think that that is far more promising than our own minds. And you know, I don't, you know, maybe there'll be like a singularity or whatever, but, you know, I don't know. I just kind of have fun with it at the end. So it's a kind of like a, you know, it's like at the end of a Stanley Kubrick film where shit just gets weird and you're like, whoa, what's happening? You know, I wanted to put that sort of experience in the end of the book.
I loved it. I just wonder if it's going to be a singularity kind of event or something more gradual that we start to have, that we have control over and we can make decisions. But is it going to be this, like, we wake up in the morning and we turn on the news and it's like, all over the world, robots have taken over the cities and, you know, and turning cars, like, over and, you know, like...
It's like the Terminator.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Universe.
Yeah. Last question, what do you dare to hope for?
You know, I dare to hope for a lot of things. So the last section of the book is called I Dare to Hope ... And it's just a list of things that, you know, you get to the end of the book and it's like, okay, we have to hope for something. Like, it's impossible to not hope for something. But we've also just gone through like 300 pages explaining the precarious nature of our own hopes. And so I wrap the book up with kind of my own, like, these are the things that I dare to hope for, that I'm nervous hoping for these things, but these are the things that I hope for. And I kind of run through them and explain them. And they relate to a lot of the concepts discussed throughout the book, ideas about technology and information and media and the climate. You know, all sorts of stuff. So it's kind of my little farewell after like the wild, crazy ride of the book.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. And I hope that your next book does not become a New York Times bestseller so that you can have more you can hope for in life for the rest of your life.
Thanks, Scott. I hope you fail.
Well, that was clever, though, right? That was clever.
It was very clever.
Like, you see what I did there. You see what I did there.
I definitely do.
But I do, you know, like, I'm scared to, usually my guests at the end, I say, I wish you well. And I'm almost scared to say that.
Yeah.
The way you've turned
it. It's to say what well is. You know?
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so I don't know what to wish for you or hope for you, but my gut instinct is telling me that I wish, you know, for your contentment. How about that?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I'll go with it.
All the best, man.
Thanks, dude. Yeah. Last thing, can you, we didn't plug the book at the end there. Oh,
you're right. Okay. Oh, yeah. I wanted to plug your book. Like, you know, dude, what do you want to say about it?
Sure. So Everything is Fucked, a book about hope. It's out May 14th everywhere. So check it out. And then also I'm going to be on a speaking tour around the country, and check that out at markmanson.net/speaking-tour. So yeah, get the book, come out and see me. It'd be a great time.
Thanks, Mark. Also, please say hi to Big Willie for me. Will Smith, you have a top secret project with him, right? Am I allowed to at least say that?
I don't think it's top secret anymore. So I'm co-authoring his book with him.
Awesome.
Which is going to be amazing.
I can't wait. And I devour all your writing. So thanks again for being on the Psychology Podcast today.
Thanks, dude. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.